From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the latest on mediation between Michigan State and Larry Nassar's victims.
The university has said in the last weeks that they do want to reach a settlement and that it seems to be a priority.
So why is the school also moving to dismiss federal lawsuits brought by survivors? Plus the new tax bill. It won't affect your filing for 2017, but get ready for big changes in 2018.
I like to say this is the most complicated simplification I've ever seen of taxes.
The great auto disconnect.
It's electric vehicles coming out of the wazoo in this industry, and nobody is buying them.
And Michigan against Loyola.
I mean, look, Loyola, God bless them. Great team, great run, great story. You are the 11-seeded team, which means you're in the top 44. That's not that high.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This week, Michigan State University's interim president, John Engler, announced the school was returning to mediation with victims of Larry Nassar, saying the university remains committed to reaching a fair settlement with all the survivors. But at the same time, MSU lawyers were trying again to dismiss the numerous federal lawsuits it's facing. Matt Mencarini of the Lansing State Journal is here with us. So, Matt, this return to mediation, exactly what's being mediated and why did it have to be restarted?
They entered a mediation phase in 2017. It started in the fall and it wrapped up in December without a settlement or a resolution to the cases. Michigan State and USA Gymnastics and others filed their motions to dismiss. Now all parties are returning to the negotiation table to see if they can reach a settlement. John Engler has said since he took over, and the university has said in the last weeks that they do want to reach a settlement and that it seems to be a priority. So now they're returning with new leadership at the university to probably see if they can reach a number that works for all parties.
And yet, even as that's happening, MSU lawyers filed a motion to dismiss the federal lawsuits filed by survivors. That happened, as you reported, at 5:45 on Wednesday.
Yeah, it was just hours after the federal judge officially granted the order to send them into mediation. And what this renewed motion to dismiss does is it addresses the new plaintiffs who had joined the lawsuits since the initial motion to dismiss. When that was filed, there were about 140 suing the university, and now we're up to more than 250 suing the university, USA Gymnastics, Twistars, Gymnastics Club, and Diamonddale, which also filed their renewed motion to dismiss yesterday. All those organizations and a few individuals will be part of the mediation.
You spoke, I know, with Bob Young, the former Michigan Supreme Court Chief Justice, who is now a private attorney that's been hired by MSU, about this. I guess help the non-legal types understand that at the same time you're saying we want to mediate, you're also filing motions to dismiss.
They released a statement from Bob Young kind of saying why they felt they needed to file this renewed motion to dismiss. Some of the civil attorneys have said that that wasn't necessary and that they actually asked the university not to file this renewed motion to dismiss. It could be one of the in the legal weeds a little bit, wanting to preserve their stance on a number of issues. Going into mediation, one thing it does do is it pushes back the plaintiff's deadline to respond to the motions to dismiss until May 10th. And what that May 10th date does, it could give us a glimpse of, at least initially, how long the parties anticipate the mediation may go on for.
Yeah, I'm wondering, when I saw that, when you reported that no responses are required to May 10th, I'm wondering if that implies MSU is seeking to hammer out settlements by that date.
That's hard to tell at this point. I think it's an indication of a general time frame that they expect to go into mediation. The first mediation phase, I believe, was for 90 days, and then it was extended. The order signed going into mediation did not include publicly available dates or time frames, so it appears to be a little bit more open-ended, but that May 10th date might be an indication of at least the initial sense of how long they want to talk for.
Matt, were you able to speak with any of the survivors' attorneys?
Not on this issue. A few of them have put out public statements about it. I don't think they wanted the university to file this renewed motion, and I believe that they've said that they asked for the university not to. Both sides differ on the necessity of this motion. The timing is odd, hours after they are granted to go into mediation, but it may have something to do with the deadlines to respond to certain things, because Twistars also filed their motion in the morning of Wednesday.
Shifting to something else that's in your story in the Lansing State Journal, you get records showing how much Michigan State has paid out already in legal fees and public relations fees. What'd you find?
As of early March, they had been billed for almost $9.7 million for attorneys and outside consultants. $9 million of that is for attorneys, the bulk of that being for two law firms, the lead law firm. On the civil litigation, that's Patrick Fitzgerald's law firm, and the other law firm that's charging up to, for at least two attorneys, more than $1,100 an hour is the law firm handling the insurance aspects of this. Also in some of the recent records I received was an invoice from a PR firm in New York that had billed for $500,000 in January. Among the work that they were doing was monitoring social media conversations and activity related to the university and Nassar, and a lot of that picked up on tweets from victims and their families, journalists, celebrities, politicians, before, during, and after Nassar's Ingham County sentencing.
Earlier this month, the state Senate passed a package of bills in reaction to the Nassar scandal. MSU and other universities were against them. Remind us again briefly what those bills would do.
A number of those bills directly address some of the defenses that the university has put forward in their motions to dismiss, the fact that the university and its employees are immune from such lawsuits. The statute of limitations would be the other specific one for the civil lawsuits, basically lifting the statute of limitations for the victims of childhood sexual abuse. You know, in addition to the university saying it and its employees are immune from lawsuits related to Nassar's criminal conduct, they've said that most of the claims are time-barred, meaning the statute of limitations has expired for those lawsuits to be brought. The legislation now in the state house would undo some of those and allow for pretty much all of the plaintiffs to go forward with their lawsuits.
Where does it stand now with the state house?
I believe it's still waiting on first action. I believe they were going to pick it up once they got back from their spring break.
Matt Mancarini with the Lansing State Journal. Matt, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for our weekly check-in with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howells. And this week, Daniel's thinking about something he calls the Great Auto Disconnect. Daniel, what's that?
It's electric vehicles coming out of the wazoo in this industry, and nobody is buying them. You have a situation where electric vehicles account for about 1% of the market. And as I think a lot of your listeners know, consumers are buying more and more trucks and SUVs in all sorts of different sizes and configurations. So essentially, you have government policy that is driving and dictating electric vehicles and adoption of electric vehicles, and manufacturers that are responding to it, both because of what's happening in the United States from a regulatory perspective, but as well as other parts of the world. And those pesky consumers are not cooperating.
Well, in fact, I kind of had to laugh when you opened your column today telling us how as the car companies, U.S. and overseas, are turning them out, pushing electric vehicles this week at the New York International Auto Show with a buyer's wanted campaign, this plaint of please buy our EV. As you say, what a disconnect.
Well, you know, and that's the Auto Alliance that is pushing this because they represent the entire industry. And they're saying it's not good for the industry to see electric vehicles on the showroom floors. Nobody's buying. And the other thing that's interesting is manufacturers, take Ford Motor Company, for example. A couple of weeks ago, they went through a whole long product layout about their plans for the next 2 years. And one of the things they said is that all of our SUVs will be available in the marketplace with a gas electric hybrid powertrain. Now, what's interesting about that is that that used to be considered a premium upcharge, you know, $3,000, $4,000 on a model to get a hybrid. So in a lot of cases, when fuel is closer to $2 a gallon than $4 a gallon, people would say, why do I need to do that? What's the payback for me? How long do I have to own the car to get the payback? Now, because battery prices have come down, there's going to be less and less of an upcharge for that, and it's going to be a viable option for a lot of people. So we're going to start to see whether people really make the move. I mean, it is true that an electric motor has a lot more oomph out of the hole even than a big gas engine, just because they're able to deliver a lot of torque to the wheels. Mm. So for some folks, that might be an option, particularly if you're driving a really big SUV. You will get some savings if you have a hybrid version of it.
But if you stop and think about, we are just one great big oil crisis away from consumers deciding, hey, maybe these EVs are what I want if gas prices are rocketing back up to $4.
Well, that's true. true, but what's, I think, changed in the energy markets is the United States is a much bigger producer of oil than it had historically been. And it's really changed the whole dynamic in the energy markets. And if you talk to auto executives, I mean, look, they got to look at this stuff. They can't ignore it. They know history. And their product plans are somewhat predicated on what their economists think is the long-term trends in terms of oil prices. And I think the feeling here is that going forward, at least in the midterm, we're looking at stuff that's going to be closer to $2 a gallon than $4.
Do you think the future for these EVs and the zero emission vehicles lies with American consumers or buyers overseas? I guess I'm asking, are we hitting a point where American tastes do not drive the production decisions the way they used to?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. You know, you've got government policy in countries like China that is going electric, whether the consumers like it or not. They've got much worse emissions problems than we have in the United States or in Western Europe. And they are clearly moving in that direction. The EU is also moving in that direction. Governments in Britain, Germany, and France have raised the specter of abolishing the internal combustion engine at some date in the future. Now, when they get a little deeper into this and they start to understand what the implications are for their industrial base, they may take a different view of this. Clearly right now, I think that is driving it. Now, in terms of American tastes, the one exception to that, I think you could say, at least in cars, is China. American vehicles are very popular in China. Buick is popular. Lincoln is getting increasingly popular. And some of the designs of these vehicles that are being sold in the United States, if you look in like the back seats, you will see they're plusher. There are more amenities that are available to the backseat passengers. And in part, that's because of the Chinese market. Because one of the rites of passage, if you will, or that to show that people have arrived, is that you're riding in the back of the car, not in the front.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Larry Nassar scandal is not the first time Michigan State University has been embroiled in a national controversy. More than 50 years ago, the school became linked with America's war in Vietnam. Eric Scigliano wrote a piece for Politico this week titled "The University That Launched a CIA Front Operation in Vietnam." His father was MSU political science professor Robert Scigliano. He took part in a Michigan State University operation in Vietnam. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
Good to have you with us. So tell us, what was Michigan State University doing in Vietnam in the 1950s?
Well, it was actually involved before there was an American war in Vietnam and got involved very shortly after the French war in Vietnam ended. The university sponsored what was called the Michigan State University Advisory Group to help the fledgling South Vietnamese government set up a civil administration, everything from a government library to the police forces, assisting them with training and material as well.
So when did this all begin? When did Michigan State University people start interacting and consulting with people in the state of Vietnam?
It began in 1955, the year after the Geneva Accords partitioned the country and the French left, though the connection began even earlier when a former foreign language specialist with U.S. intelligence named Wesley Fischel met an exiled politician from Vietnam named Nguyen Dinh Diem in Japan. They became good friends. They discovered they had a lot of shared interest and strong anti-communist sentiment. Fischel, in 1952, became a professor at Michigan State University, and he kind of brought Diem into the university fold.
And MSU President John Hanna, as you spell out in your piece in Politico, he really embraced this idea. What did he think it would do for MSU and MSU's image?
Well, I think he was strongly interested on several counts. He had been an assistant secretary of defense and was deeply connected in Washington, D.C. He also was very much dedicated to the anti-communist cause, and he was really a visionary expansionist. You know well just what he did to build the university, expanded the student body by something like 12-fold, changed it from Michigan State College to Michigan State University. And he saw this overseas outreach as a natural extension of the land grant mission before he would say the entire state is our campus. As they got into this program, he said, the entire world is our campus.
Now, the headline, the title of your piece for Politico is the university that launched a CIA front operation in Vietnam. So how did the CIA get into this?
Well, the CIA asked to station some of its people as professors in one corner of the office of the program, and initially the university readily agreed. This was not at all unusual at the time. Dozens, perhaps hundreds, of private overseas operations, both academic missions and media operations, including those of CBS News, Time Magazine, and the New York Times, served as cover for CIA operatives in those years.
So what was the undoing of this program, if you will?
You know, several causes. The CIA's involvement was a big problem because though it was nominally secret, of course, the word got out. Anybody who wanted to know did. And Michigan State professors who were doing research and advising out in the field were exposed to criticism and possible danger, being mistaken for CIA agents, which they were not, really. And, you know, it just got to be a bad fit. Finally, in 1959, word came down from the chief of the project to my father, who was in Saigon, to pass the word to the CIA that they had to leave. Michigan State would no longer accommodate them. And, you know, that was one step in the unraveling of really of the university's relationship with the government. President Ziem's tactics, he was growing more and more isolated from and resented by the Buddhist majority in the country. There were, you know, demonstrations, really a civil uprising in the South. And Fischel and others kind of pled with him not to come down so hard, to at least moderate his tactics, which he did not do. Mm-hmm. And they wrote about it publicly. My father wrote an article, probably the first one, for a scholarly journal on the political parties in Vietnam, and talked about how they had been repressed. This was the Democratic opposition in the South, and recommending a more moderate approach. Ziem was not happy with that. Several other professors wrote articles subsequently for the New Republic that were, you know, much more vehement in denouncing the repression. And Ziem was livid at this. He complained. Fischel went back to Vietnam to try and work things out with him, but said that, you know, academic freedom was academic freedom, and that they couldn't stop the publication of articles like that. And he said then, okay, the contract with Michigan State would not be renewed, and the whole thing shut down in 1962.
So Michigan State people were out of there, as you say, fortunate not to be there, missed the massive military buildup, and also the fact that Ziem was killed in that uprising. How did this fallout hang around Michigan State? What kind of fallout did it experience?
Well, you know, it sort of took a few years to come to national prominence. My father and Guy Fox, another MSU professor, co-wrote a report that was then published by an academic press on the project, kind of reviewing what had happened and taking some measured criticism of what didn't work. And that was in 1965. In 1966, Ramparts magazine, which was really the cutting-edge, muckraking, left-wing magazine of the time, published an expose with a very eye-catching caricature of the famous Madame Nu, Ziem's sister-in-law and most provocative spokesperson, as an MSU cheerleader. And it hit pretty hard on the CIA connection, called it the university on the make, and got a lot of attention.
Boy, oh boy, what is the lesson for any academic tempted to take part in American efforts, U.S. government efforts to remake another nation?
I think studying Michigan State's experience could be very valuable. And, you know, one could wish that some of the academics and self-described public intellectuals who pushed to get the United States into Iraq in the early years of the George W. Bush administration had taken that example to heart. It's also, you know, remarkable how the sort of officials in MSU's support for Ngo Dinh Diem sort of foreshadowed the support by many of the advocates for the Iraq war for a guy named Ahmed Chalabi, who was, you know, in exile, determined to overthrow Saddam's government and, you know, would be president himself. And that, again, didn't turn out so well.
Well, it's a fascinating piece of history, well worth your time to go to Politico.com. Eric Sigliano's piece, The University That Launched a CIA Front Operation in Vietnam. Eric, thank you so much for sharing that story, your father's work, and I know you're drawing on your own memories of being in Vietnam as a young boy. It was a fascinating read. We want to thank you for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
As controversy swirled around Bob Dylan's 2017 Nobel Prize for Literature, some argued that Dylan wasn't even the first songwriter to win that prize. That honor may belong to Indian songwriter, poet, and philosopher Rabindranath Tagore. He was born in Calcutta in 1861. He was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1913. He lived until 1941, and this is his music.
बोले थे जब जब रात बोले
My guest, Moushumi Banerjee, is the voice that you're hearing. She grew up listening to Tagore's music, and she's working to make the music and lyrics of Rabindranath Tagore more accessible to the world, and doing that with her project Tagore Beyond Boundaries. Moushumi, welcome. It's so good to have you here.
Thank you so much.
You grew up listening to this man's music. Describe how he influenced you, especially as a child, as you heard it.
Oh, absolutely. I still remember summer nights, and in India, like when it's full summer, you have jasmine and gardenia and all of those flowers blooming. And my grandpa had a very beautiful garden. So I would fall asleep, like with all the aroma of those flowers drifting in the wind. And my mother would sing to me lullabies. And guess what? These were songs of Tagore. Those were my childhood lullabies, and then they became my life's mantra.
Agunir porushmuni chumau prani ijiban punno karo ijiban punno karo.
So he has been a presence in your life for all your life.
Absolutely.
How important is he in India?
Oh, he pretty much dominates the literary and the musical landscape of the Indian subcontinent. And I should mention that not only in India, but in Bangladesh too. Interestingly, another fact about Tagore is, to my knowledge, Tagore is the only poet-composer whose creations have been adopted by two nations as the national anthem. So Indian national anthem as well as Bangladesh's national anthem were composed by Tagore.
And when you think of the songs, and I know he wrote hundreds of songs, didn't he? Were there main themes, or did he explore anything and everything in his songs?
So actually, he wrote more than 2,000 songs.
Well, that is more than hundreds and hundreds.
Yeah, yes. 2,200 plus songs. Mm. And very interestingly, his songs, I mean, I really think it's sort of a breathtaking fusion of his poetic and musical genius. And his songs, I mean, he experimented with various elements, and he used like elements from Indian classical music, but then he experimented with elements from the West, from Irish folk tunes, from like folk tunes from Bengal and from what is now Bangladesh. So he was a man who sort of loved to experiment, and he created a whole genre. Rabindrasangeet, the genre that he created, Sangeet means music in Bengali, still is the number one chart buster in, you know, in the music industry in Bengal.
What makes his music and his work so hard to access and get into the world outside of Bengal?
Part of it is the language barrier, because these are written in Bengali. But I think part of it is the fact that it sort of like remained in the East. There hasn't been any attempts, to my knowledge, to really bring his music outside India, outside the Indian subcontinent, and to open it for the Western platform. Language is one issue, but then it's also the music kind of the notations. Mm-hmm. You know, these are written in Indian notation, and that's not accessible for Western musicians. You know, I like to say that this is a work that is being, you know, it takes a whole village to raise a child, and it took a whole village to actually sort of do this.
And how is your nonprofit Tagore Beyond Boundaries helping to kind of open up the rest of the world to his poetry and to his songs?
So the initial attempt was to take his songs and, you know, take a selection of his 100 most popular songs and create Western transcriptions of those. That was a huge task. The initial phase of the project was kind of more of an academic pursuit. But music has to be heard, right? I mean, that's ultimately
the point of it.
That's the point of it. So what we are now doing is we take, you know, like we have transcribed those songs into Western music notation, and now we have orchestrated some of those compositions for the Western performers.
And are you doing this all yourself, or do you have someone you're working with?
Sort of the co-director on this project, my partner on this project is Dr. Rajib Chakraborty. He's a very famous sarod musician who is based in India.
Well, let's take a listen now to a composition. Well, and you're collaborating, it's so interesting, with Pioneer High School. So their orchestra and choir will be performing Tagore's music in April. How did that all come to be?
Oh, that's kind of that's an awesome story, and it has been a wonderful journey. Interestingly, I'm a member of the Rotary International of Ann Arbor, and I met someone there, Tom Millard, who is a retired music educator in the Ann Arbor Public Schools. So I talked to him about this project. He took a deep interest in the project. And I said that ultimately I want Western musicians to perform this. And can we actually engage kids? So that's how we started the dialogue with Pioneer. We went down there, and Jonathan Glaw, who is the director of orchestra at Pioneer, we met him and we went to his classroom, and the kids, you know, like since then it has been just like a wonderful, wonderful journey.
And they've been in rehearsals for a performance. When is that performance coming up?
April 17th.
So how have you seen students and their teachers reacting to Tagore's music? This music you know so well, but it's so new to them.
So it has been fascinating to see them, because one of the kids mentioned that, you know, like the sounds are new, right? Mm-hmm. They have been having a lot of fun, like, you know, sort of rehearsing, and then we send the scores have been prepared by somebody from India. It has been a real, real exchange.
Real collaboration.
A real collaboration.
Well, the Pioneer High School Orchestra and Choir performance of Tagore Soul and Strings happens Tuesday night, April 17th. It'll be held at Washtenaw Community College Towsley Auditorium. Moushumi Banerjee is a research professor of biostatistics at the University of Michigan School of Public Health, the singing professor, and the creator of Tagore Beyond Boundaries. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time to talk sports as we say hello to Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. And we're talking about Final Four. You've got number one seed Villanova against number one seed Kansas and number three seed Michigan against that true Cinderella, an 11 seed afterthought from the Missouri Valley Conference, the Loyola Ramblers. It has been quite fun watching them.
It has been quite a ride. Of course, the nun has become famous. Fear the nun, as I say.
Sister Jean.
Sister Jean Dolores Schmidt, 98 years old.
Who played, I heard this, played, she was a basketball star in high school, 1933
really?
To 1937.
Put that in your hat.
That's
how
right.
About that one? However, I have to point out, she said that she swore off losing for Lent, and it has worked. However, Cindy, what is tomorrow?
Well, tomorrow's Good Friday.
Thank you.
Well, but Lent officially goes till Easter Sunday at midnight. So,
Okay. Well,
Holy Saturday is still considered.
When you're an Episcopalian, that's how you lose these things. So.
Okay.
There you go. So we'll see. But they're going to lose on Saturday night to Michigan.
You really believe that?
Certain of it.
Why?
Because the run is over. Michigan has played out of four games in the tournament. They've played poorly in three on offense, very poorly, and still won all three. They're playing defense, and if their offense isn't just average, they'll beat this team. And look, Loyola, God bless them. Great team, great run, great story. You are the 11-seeded team, which means you're in the top 44. That's not that high. So,
but we have seen. Are we past the point of seeing those big surprises we saw in the first round? And the second
cynic
round?
Says yes.
Okay, the cynic says yes, and of course we have Jalen Rose's 110-year-old grandmother who's dissing Sister Jean, and we also have John Dingell. As soon as Michigan got to the Final Four, somebody put a meme up of Sister Jean, and then here's John Dingell wearing, you know, we got two nonagenarians. He's wearing his Michigan shirt. So I guess we'll see the battle of the nonagenarians.
It's a fun rivalry. It's fun to see it play out like this.
You know, it's interesting. You know, we've heard a lot that this is Loyola's first tournament appearance since 1985, but it won the NCAA title in 1963 and helped make some sports history in the making. Tell us a little about that.
You know that, Cindy, and few do. The Ramblers won the title game 63, but that's not the best story. The best story is they played Mississippi State along the way at Jennison Fieldhouse, of course, well known to us as Michigan State's backyard. And, of course, at the time in Mississippi, the teams were all white, and you were not even allowed to play teams that had African Americans on them. Mm. And not only did they decide to play in East Lansing, the captain of Mississippi State, a guy named Joe Dan Gold, that's a good Southern name for you, he went out to half court, met the Ramblers team captain, Jerry Harkness, a black guard from Harlem, and shook his hand. Now, that is nothing today, obviously. To do anything less would be, to anybody,
of course,
would be insanely offensive.
But 1963.
It took some courage to do this, and you needed both sides to make this thing work. And more touchingly, many years later, when Joe Dan Gold passed away, Harkness was invited to his funeral. And when he went up to see his former opponent, a big framed photo of him shaking Harkness's hand, the photo from center court at Jennison Fieldhouse, that was displayed prominently at his funeral as clearly one of the highest moments of his life. This is a guy who won the national title that year. You know, cutting the net and all that should be up there. But that moment was centered. And that, to me, is sports at its absolute best. Sometimes sports is able to motivate us to be better people than we are normally. And this is one of those cases.
It is something, a very important point in college sports history then, a big push toward integrating college athletics.
The nun is great, but that one's greater.
That is great. So who do you think will be facing each other on Monday for the finals?
I think it's Michigan and then probably Villanova, but either one of those, that's a dogfight, man.
Yeah.
Villanova and Kansas, sorry, Michigan fans, they're the two best teams left. However, if Michigan can get there, and again, I think they will, They will have to play one of their best games of the year, but they have to hit on offense and on defense. They've got to do both. If they do both, then it's a toss-up game, the same way it was against Louisville, 5 years ago. So anything is possible.
All right, and we got a couple of Michigan-centric teams
yes,
we want to give a hat tip to.
Let's get some happy news out here.
Let's do it.
The Ferris State Bulldogs. They're known for their hockey. They got to the Final Four in Division I hockey a few years ago. But in Division II basketball, they are now your national champions. So
that's
Bulldogs,
great.
Hats off. And we turn over to Benton Harbor High School, whose basketball team beat Grand Rapids Catholic Central last weekend. The first state title for Benton Harbor since 1965, almost Loyola stuff.
Yes, yes.
And for a town that is clearly hurting, that's got a city manager, now somebody else in charge of their schools, they know how much I was there a couple weeks ago. This is a great little tonic to put some pride back in and show what can be done.
And finally, we've got opening day was postponed from today to tomorrow, presumably because of bad weather. What do you want to say about what fans might expect from the Tigers this season? I wince.
Not much. Back to Benton Harbor.
Even with the new manager.
Afraid so.
Yeah, new skipper. You don't think it's going to make a difference?
I think it's going to make a difference. I think he's very good with young talent, and that's what you're going to have. He'll have to develop them, but don't your October's going to be free this year, fans. No World Series.
Michigan Radio Sports Commentator John Eubacon. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
What?
When?
Why?
I am curious.
There is just so much to talk about in this very diverse state of ours. We can't possibly know about it all. And that's where you come in. We want to know what you're curious about. If you've got a question about Michigan, anything you've always wondered about, send it along by going to the Am I Curious page at michiganradio.org. The clock is ticking, and CPAs and tax attorneys are working long, long hours right now as 2017 taxes are due in a little more than a couple of weeks. But what should we be doing now so that filing for 2018 goes smoothly in light of the huge tax reform bill recently passed? With us now via Skype is Leon Labreck. He's managing partner and CEO of LJPR Financial Advisors, and he's a board member of the Michigan Association of Certified Public Accountants. Thanks for joining us, Leon. We need some wisdom.
Oh, good to be here.
First of all, to get us all on the same page, Leon, do taxpayers need to worry about any changes right now as we're filing our 2017 taxes?
For our 17 returns, we're probably okay. We should be taking advantage of all the deductions we will get only for 17. So, for example, some of our state and local tax deductions are changing. Some of our interest deductions are changing, but particularly things like employee expenses, those would change. But for the most part, our 17 returns should be just like our 16 returns or our 15 returns. The thing we have to pay attention to is what changes for 18.
Yes.
There's where we have some pretty dramatic differences, and we have to do things reasonably quick. I mean, as soon as you're done with your 17 returns, start working on your 18 returns.
Ooh, well then let's dive into this and talk about how our 2018 returns are going to be different and what we need to do as we get ready, as you say, jump right in and start preparing. Let's start with personal income taxes. How will income be taxed differently in 2018?
Well, for the most part, everyone's tax rate is going to be lower than it is now. So you're in a lower bracket if you're making the same amount of money. What has happened to most people who have withholdings is their withholdings changed about a month ago. In fact, some people noticed that it was a big change. Some noticed it was a small change. Really important to go check that against last year's tax return to see if you're doing the right amount. The IRS just came out with tables, and they don't know whether or not we're married and whether we've got certain interest deductions, whether we have other kinds of expenses. All of those things have an effect on how much our taxes will be for 18. So you might be humming along saying, oh, wow, I'm going to get a big refund, and then find out not only do you not have a refund, you're going to be paying taxes and maybe even a penalty. Mm-hmm. So the first important tip, check your withholdings. Make sure they're right and check them against your 2017 return.
Okay. And explain to us a little more about how deductions have changed for 2018. And my understanding is more people will be taking the standard deduction next year.
Yeah. So the two biggest changes for individuals is we no longer have personal exemptions. So we don't get a deduction for our kids. We don't get a deduction for ourselves. But instead, we get a much larger standard deduction in a lower bracket. So if I were claiming two exemptions plus my wife and I had four exemptions. Now I don't have any exemptions. But now I have a larger standard deduction. So for most people, and I count about 90% of the taxpayers in the state of Michigan, will basically pay less tax and have a much simpler tax return. Hmm. And then about 10% will pay more or have something else change.
For whom are these changes more complicated? Who falls into that 10%?
Well, the 10% really hits a couple of people that I see pretty dramatically. One is if you have kids over 17 and under 26 going to college, that changes for you. That's a big one because you're losing the exemption for the college-age kid, but you're also not getting a child credit for that kid. So that's going to change for those folks, and we see that one there. And that's kind of temporary. A big one is if you're supporting a mom or a dad or an adult person, you know, as an exemption. And there you could have a pretty dramatic one. So if, let's say, your mom's in a nursing home and you're funding her nursing home care, there's a lot of changes there. And that's one that you have to kind of look at pretty closely and pretty quick. Of course, the monster, the biggest one, is business taxes. If you own a business or a partner in a business, there's where the changes are absolutely disruptive.
And so is it more for small business owners where the changes are really going to be felt?
Absolutely. So this is the biggest change in small business since Eisenhower was the president. It's a profound change. And I like to say this is the most complicated simplification I've ever seen of taxes. It's an unbelievable change in what goes on. But in general, small business owners, and in Michigan, we're talking about literally hundreds of thousands of people. This is everybody with a LLC or everybody who's a PC. This is our veterinarian or our doctor or our dentist or the person who just runs a nail salon. All of those people now have an opportunity to deduct up to 20% of their income. But the rules are very, very complicated. And I mean, it's a huge thing. In fact, it's so complicated that if you're a small business owner and you're making less than $315,000, your rate is you've got the biggest tax cut in the tax bill. Hmm. Your rate goes down to about 19%. If you make an extra $50,000, your rate jumps to the highest rate in the tax bill, up to about 47%. It's vastly complicated. It really is the spot that's going to have effect on a lot of people. But here's the interesting thing. You have to start looking at it right now because you can't make these changes in November. If you wait until November, it doesn't do you any good. You have to start doing things and changing the way you do your accounting now. That's where a lot of small business owners are really scratching their heads. And I'm even seeing CPAs scratch their heads going, I'm going to get through last year's tax return first, and then I'm going to fix this. It's you know, a big difference.
So again, to kind of underscore what you said, get it turned in for this year and then plunge immediately into planning for next year with these changes in mind. And it certainly sounds like if it's confusing the professionals, then you want that professional in there trying to help that sort out for your business.
Absolutely. So as soon as your CPA recovers from tax season and gets over the headache that they have, you know, in May, to, you know, go over and have a cup of coffee and say, you know, hey, what's my return going to look like this year? Here's an example. If I was a veterinarian and I was, you know, had what's called a pass-through entity, and I was making, let's say, you know, $100,000 as a veterinarian, but I was taking it all as salary, I'm not getting any benefit of this 20% pass-through deduction. I can't take any of it. So I would go to my CPA and say, how do I manage to get this into pass-through income? Or I might say, I'm a veterinarian, I want to buy a new x-ray machine. Should I write the entire x-ray machine off or should I delay it over a period of time? Mm-hmm. They helped us out as small business owners, but they made it really, really complicated.
Leon Lebrecht, what about the people who work for the gig economy? They drive Uber, they deliver for Amazon. The folks who are not working for an employer who withholds taxes from a paycheck, what do they need to know about these new tax rules?
Really important, as always, to keep good records. But it's also important to know that they can be right in the center of this new deduction called the pass-through deduction. So if I'm driving my Uber car, I'm filing a Schedule C, it makes a big difference on how I treat my expenses and what I do with my certain expenses. It also means that I'm going to get a 20% deduction on the income I make as an Uber driver. So people who run small businesses really are going to get some benefit. And the magic number is if you're single and you make $157,500 or less taxable income, or if you're married and the couple makes less than $315,000 taxable income, gigantic benefits, just a huge benefit to being a self-employed person. And we're going to see a lot of that. If I own a business, I want people to be employees because I get a deduction for that. If I run an independent contractor, I want to be the independent contractor. It'll be interesting, to say the least.
If people are confused, which I suspect...
Gee, imagine that.
Yeah, wonder where that would be from. Where can they best go to figure out what forms they need and the kind of changes they need to be making and what changes will impact them?
Of course, having a CPA help you is one of the most important things. And at the MICPA, we've been working really hard with our membership trying to make sure they've got all the tools they need. We've put a diagnostic tool on micpa.org where people can look at their returns and see what things changed. And believe me, a lot of things have changed. There's a lot of things on the web. Be careful of those. But the Treasury is going to issue regulations, I have heard, in July or so. So we'll have some regulations by then. But the most important part is getting a knowledgeable professional. And everybody's got to remember, this bill is still a baby. So we're just into this and no one's an expert yet. So my biggest advice is don't do anything too hastily, but start paying attention to it right now. I've seen people say, well, I'm going to go change what kind of business I run. I'm going to change to a corporation. Or I'm going to change to a partnership. You know, make sure you talk to people and don't just rashly jump in, because you could be sitting here next year at this time going, well, I wish I wouldn't have done that. Mm. That cost me a bunch of money.
Okay. And we all saw, you know, the big fat pile of papers, this bill with all kinds of these annotations as they were kind of building as it went, as the clock ticked away. So knowing that this is a baby bill, I understand there's already some changes in the works.
There are. The interesting thing we have to remember is a little civics lesson. This bill passed with the barest of majorities under what's called reconciliation. Mm-hmm. For it to get a technical correction, we would need 60 votes in the Senate. And last time I noticed, we had a little bit of disparity in the House and the Senate between people wanting to vote together. So we could be sitting on all these weird rules and weird things happening for quite a while. And I caution everyone to recognize that laws can change. You know, we could run off and do all kinds of things and try to get things set up and set up trusts and so on and so forth, and then find out in 4 years, a lot of these things go away. To be sure, as a CPA, there's a lot of provisions to this that are really beneficial. Some of the small business provisions are really, really good. I think some of the things on repatriation or bringing money back to the United States are really, really good. But then there, like you said, when things are done in haste, for example, if a business loses money, they can't deduct it going backward. They can only deduct 80% of it going forward. You know, we may run into a recession one of these days and we'll have startup businesses and they won't be able to deduct their losses. It's not good for startup businesses or new businesses. So I think when you get somebody running through and putting a bill through at the 11th hour, sometimes they don't think through every single ramification. And when we had the bill passed in 1981 under Ronald Reagan, 2 years later, they redid it and fixed it. And when we had under George Bush, we had EGTRA pass in 2000. 2 years later, we fixed it. I would see easily this bill will have to have some fixes. There's just too many things that are wrong with it right now that need to get fixed. It needs to be cleaned up and put in place. On the other hand, for most business owners and lots of taxpayers in the United States, this will be a good thing, but we have to pay attention to it. This is the first time in 43 years that I've seen that you really got to pay attention to these things.
Leon LeBrecq is managing partner and CEO of LJPR Financial Advisors and a director of the Michigan Association of Certified Public Accountants, the CPAs, in the spotlight at this tax season. Leon, thank you so much for your advice.
Thanks, Cindy.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Joey Horan, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.